Yeah, I would think you can. I mean, I don't frankly see the difference between open books and open notes. I mean, it means you copy it out of the book into a notebook and then bring that in. It's a class in penmanship. That's what. I presume there will not be anybody there but me and you and me, so I don't care what you bring into the class. Unless it's your lawyer. Yes. Yes, they are going to be in... Yeah, 141 Giannini. I think I've got a... I guess I ran out of those, too. Right, Monday the 21st, 121 Giannini Hall, which I'm told is what, over on Hearst?
That's right, it's over there. You go across the bridge, it's over the street.
Yes.
Can we just write out answers to the questions that come in and turn it in, or should we?
Well, I'm not sure how to, again, when I was here as an undergraduate, it had to be into blue books, and the blue books were passed out. But you could buy blue books at the student union, and many people did, and brought them out in advance. I think I've told you several times, I'm not a great believer in examinations for this kind of a course. And if they are to have any value at all, they should be used as a teaching device. Now, I feel if you brief yourself to be able to answer all of these questions intelligently, you know, enough to get through the course, you have taught yourself quite a bit. You'll know a lot more than most people in this country will, I'll tell you that, about the Vietnam War. So how you get that into your head doesn't really make that all that much difference to me.
But if it's open notes, we could essentially sort of read one of these six, write out
right.
500 words and then come in and just...
Right, or you could have somebody write it out for you and then come in and copy it. But you see, I believe that that's an educational process.
Yeah.
And the mere process of getting it down is... Anyway, you know, I want to make this almost impossible to cheat on. That's my main... I don't want to give an advantage to anybody who... I suppose you could cheat. You could send somebody else in to write the exam for you. You better hope they know what they're doing.
You don't take bribes, I take it.
Well, how much are you offering?
I doubt I can afford you.
Every man has his price, as they say.
Are you going to be passing out class evaluations?
Yes, that's another thing I'm told is in the box there. What, do they do that with the final exam or in advance? Or?
Teacher, I've already done a bunch.
All right, well, I'll get them and give them to you next Thursday then.
What's this?
This is a, you evaluate me. Since I'm quitting at the end of the course, why? Feel free to put everything down you want. Might be an advantage if you put down, I think they should hire a regular tenured faculty member. That's what I've been telling them they should do.
I have a really important question. Can we have a beer and pizza party on Thursday?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you can. Is that legal here?
Sure. If you want to call it a field trip, it's legal.
Do you have class?
Well, the question is whether you want a kind of, as I understand it, the final week is supposedly devoted in the history department, unlike political science, to cleaning up whatever loose ends you have from the year. And the main idea is like a lawyer's summation, the final brief, is that he may not introduce new evidence. And I supposedly, in the cleanup week, you do not introduce new material. You simply re-examine or summarize what has been said before. That's what I understand. Have you experienced this in other classes?
Yeah.
You history majors? So I'm not too sure what it is we should deal with here. But I thought probably the most useful thing would be if there are things in your mind that we have not discussed, not mentioned. A couple of you have mentioned this. Let's see, somebody mentioned Laos, for example. All right, I can say a little about the war in Laos. It's things like that you don't think we've treated adequately, and you want me to say something for about 5 minutes or so, or just answer questions on. All right, well, let me say a little about the war in Laos. It was, I think the most important point to make about Laos is that in cultural terms and social terms, it is totally different from Vietnam. And the Lao are not like the Vietnamese. They're more akin to the Thais, and their language is similar to Thai. But the assumption of most foreigners, and I must say even some Vietnamese, through the years has always been that Laos was sort of like a backwater of Vietnam. I think I was in Vietnam about 3 years. I went there in 1960, and I was there at least 3 years before I went to Laos for the first time. And I had this idea that Laos was just sort of like backwater, mountainous, remote Vietnam. And you don't have to be off the plane in Vientiane more than about 15 minutes before you realize that Laos is quite different, and that anything you come bring in knowing about Vietnam is not much value in the case of, you might as well be coming in from the Congo or someplace as far as, you know, being able to understand what was. So that's the first point, that whatever Laos was, it is not another Vietnam or another Cambodia, and not really another Thailand either. Second point was that there was a kind of acceptance by all parties involved, North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese and the Allied forces and the Thais and so on, that Laos could become, could remain more or less neutral. As no one really wanted Laos into the war. This applied to Cambodia too, to a very large extent. And therefore, no one had much regard for activities in Laos except in terms of the war in Vietnam. The Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, needed Laos. They needed the eastern side of it because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This was the only feasible way that they had of getting large amounts of supplies into South Vietnam. And all of this went through Laos. It went into Laos from North Vietnam, through Laos, through the very narrow strip of Laos, and into about 3 points in South Vietnam. This is an incredibly rough country. It is an impossible country to fight in any kind of, straight up and straight down. The rain comes down in Laos just by buckets. I did a very early study called Diary of an Infiltrator, in which I had about 100 captured diaries of North Vietnamese. These were mostly called regroupees, people who went south in the 1950s and then were infiltrated back and came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail at the time that it really was an arduous journey. The trail, incidentally, was not just some people had the vision, at least at the end of the war, it was sort of like the Pennsylvania Turnpike. It was never this. It was a network of roads and trails and rivers and streams and of varying degrees of development. As one chopper pilot said, from the air, Ho Chi Minh Trail looks like a plate of spaghetti. there's all kinds of weaving of routes, and some wide, some narrow, and so on. These were hardened, they were increasingly developed, and now it's more or less of an open road. It's still fairly rough because it goes through very rough country and snakes around the mountains, but it's, in the very early days it was extremely arduous. There's malaria, there's dysentery, dengue fever, plus airstrikes, plus snakes, plus you name it, and they've got it. The casualty rate in the very early days was about 50%. Anyway, from these captured diaries, we had about 100 that we had. I just pieced together a sample diary of what life was like on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the thing that that the writers of this were most impressed by was the rain. The rain in Laos just must come down in buckets. And it comes down for days on end. And so in these 100-page diaries, there would be page after page after page of describing the rain. And then the rain stopped, and they're on the trail, and he's describing this, and then they stop, and the rain comes, and there's five more pages of rain. It's not easy to describe rain, you know, in great length, but they managed to find ways to do it. Anyway, the point was that the only way the North Vietnamese had to get supplies into the South was either by sea or across the DMZ or through Laos. Those were the three basic ways. The DMZ was pretty well fortified. It was a fairly narrow choke point to begin with. The trip by sea was very hairy. They had naval patrols out, what was called Market Time, Operation Market Time, which was both Vietnamese and American naval vessels to interdict these vessels, most of which were trying to go clear around to the southern Kamau Peninsula, which is a long way to go without being detected, and not too many of them made it. So the only feasible way was to develop the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was a great masterpiece of engineering, for which General Jacques gets full credit. Very high price was paid in developing it, but it was, in a way, it's a monumental technical creation, which the Vietnamese are very proud of today, and now they run tours down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and so on. But the point is that Hanoi's interest in Laos was strictly related to the Ho Chi Minh Trail itself. The American interest was strictly interested in interdicting the trail or making life hard for those on the trail. They tried an incursion 1971, I think it was, which proved to be something less than a success. Depends on what they thought they were doing when they went in. What they found when they got in there is that there's almost no place to stand in terms of fighting a war, because again, the mountains are very steep. And so this was an incursion that went in and out, and from before that and afterwards, it was chiefly an effort to use air power, bombing, B-52s, airstrikes, and so on. It was a kind of technological war. It would send Montagnards in, commissioned Montagnards to sit on the hills overlooking the trail with these little supermarket counters, you know, and every time a truck would go by, they would push this button. And when one would go up, they'd push it and the other, and then they'd turn these in each evening, and they would look at the numbers and set them back to zero, and they go out for the next day. Now, the trouble is, these didn't tell you what was in the truck. It also didn't tell you if there was one truck was going back and forth past this guy six times a day, because he would, each time he'd go that way, he'd push this one, each time he'd push that one, and he had no way of knowing whether the truck was empty or not, or how it was the same truck. They were trying to, at the time, to predict offensives on the basis of build-up of supplies. That was the primary objective. This went on for about 3 years, and we finally abandoned it, because it became evident that, unlike in other wars, where there is a buildup of materiel and shipment of arms and movement of people in advance of an offensive. This is the way it almost always is. And if there isn't one of these, then there isn't going to be an offensive in the immediate future. This did not apply in Vietnam at all. There would be offensives that had not been preceded by big buildups. There would be big buildups which were not followed by offensives. And the basic reason, I think, for this is what was being moved down the trail was simply being stockpiled all the way down. So if they'd move it from Vin halfway down, it'd be a huge effort. All they were really trying to do was to fill up their caves and warehouses halfway down the trail. It does not mean that there was an offensive coming. And the same thing in moving it down to final position. It could be moved down today and wouldn't be used maybe for a year. So there wasn't any sort of one-on-one. Aside from that, Laos was pretty much a... the Lao are very good-natured people, I think. Americans that went to Laos liked Laos very much. They had a kind of an attachment to them. They fell in love with the place, more so than they did, most of them did in Vietnam or Cambodia. The Lao like to have water fights, and they like to sleep a lot. They really are quite, you know, laid-back people. Typical Californians, I guess. Dennis Warner, the Australian journalist, was telling the story of the effort in 1962 to when there was a Laos conference in Geneva. And the whole idea was to try to set up a neutral government that everybody could live with, that is, the North Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Americans, and so on. So they established what was called the Three Princes solution. Namely, there was a red prince, a right-wing prince, and a middle-of-the-road prince, and they were all related. They were all cousins. Everybody in Laos, you get the impression, is related to everybody else. Certainly at the top, it's a very small, familial relationship. Anyway, this was the Three Princes solution, so-called solution. The Troika government was established, and Moscow endorsed this, and the United States endorsed it. Everybody thought it was, for their own purposes, it would serve a good purpose. And so Warner has said that this was being administered by the International Control Commission, the ICC, which had people from Canada, from Poland, and from India. Those were the three members, a non-communist, a communist, and a neutralist representative. This was Poland, the communist country, Canadians, or a number of people, but at the time it was the Canadians, and the Indians. And so Warner said he was sitting on the platform when they inaugurated this Three Princes solution, and sitting next to him is the Polish ICC colonel, who he determined in talking to him was an ex-coal miner and the son of a coal miner and a true proletariat, that he was built like a tank, and he looked like a tank, he looked like a wrestler, and he didn't think he thought he was a true, typical proletariat. And so I was quite surprised when he turned to him, here's Warner, decadent capitalist journalist, and saying, "Tell me, Colonel, do you think that this government is going to succeed?" And the Pole said, "This isn't a government, this is a comic opera." Now, I think that same sense of this is more of a comic opera than it is a true government prevailed throughout the entire region. I mean, it was a central view of the communists, the Vietnamese, the Chinese, and the Russians. It was essentially the view of the Americans. And I don't mean to make this as a deprecating thing. I mean, I think most people who went to Laos, most Americans, had quite the opposite reaction. I mean, they really fell in love with the place. There was a State Department officer, remember Frank Nelson, who had all of his service in Europe, Paris, London, Rome, and suddenly he found himself in Saigon as personnel officer. And he lived in the hall across the street, apartment across the hall from us, and I'd never thought too much of Frank because he struck me as being a strictly striped pants, tea-pushing State Department type, who hated Vietnam and, you know, hated Asia, didn't want to be out there, wanted to go back to Paris, was told either he goes to Saigon or he quits, that's his choice. So he went to Saigon, and then I ran into him in the street one, after he'd been there about a year, and he's got orders to go to Vientiane for about 30 days, temporary duty. The personnel officer there died suddenly, and so Washington said, you know, you go up there and take over the personnel work for 30 days till we get somebody in there. And Frank was just livid, you know, Jesus, this is bad enough to be in Saigon, but God, go to Vientiane. And I really think I should quit, you know, to hell with this all. And I said, God, it's, you know, 20 years, Frank, you don't want to throw it all over. Well, I don't know. So off he goes. The next thing I know is about 3 months later, I run into him in the street again. Meanwhile, I know that all his goods had been moved out of his apartment. So something had happened to him. I didn't bother, you know, I didn't care that much. And I ran into him in the street, and I said, what's happening to you? Oh, I'm on my way back to Laos in a permanent 3-year assignment. I said, really? Yeah. I thought you couldn't stand the place. I thought, well, yeah, but you know, there is something about Laos. People there are really quite nice. I really like the place. So off he went to Laos. And I had that happen to a number of people that I know. And you say to them, what is it about this place that gets you people? Because you don't really feel it when you go in there. I mean, it seems like a nice backwater place, but there does not seem to be any kind of special attraction to it. And so I never did understand this. I just know that some of my best friends over in the Foreign Service over the years went to Laos and got seduced, if you will, by the place and became real Lao lovers. And of course, these are the ones now in the United States, particularly some of the ex-military, who are most vociferous about how we sold out the Hmong and the Highlands people of Laos, who were working for us, the Green Berets, and working for Special Forces, the CIA, and whom we just dumped at the end, just abandoned. And a lot of them got out, but a lot of them didn't. And this had much more of an emotional effect on Americans. The Americans in Laos than it ever did in Vietnam. There were the three princes. Pathet Lao was under the Red Prince Souphanouvong at the time. The Highlands people, you have the lowlands Lao, and then you have the ethnic minorities in the Highlands, and that's one major division. And the Highlands people, Minongs and all the Montagnard tribes, are generally against lowland Lao. And this is a traditional antipathy. You find the same thing in Vietnam and to some extent in Cambodia. And what we were doing, CIA and the US and the Thais actually more than we were, Thais were running a lot of these operations in the Highlands. I think the U.S. was funding some of them, but what they were trying to do was to get the Highlanders to give the Pathet Lao, who are mostly in Phuong Sali and Sam Nua provinces, a hard time, harassing them any way that they could, and were pretty good at it. Under a man named Vang Pao, General Vang Pao, who's now in the United States, got a ranch in Arizona, or in Montana. And again, the Lao in this country are much more homogeneous. They're much more unified. There's not the divisiveness that you find among ethnic Vietnamese, who tend to fractionate. The Lao are much more and particularly the upland, they're very monolithic. I mean, some young Manong wants to get married, he'll call Vong Pao in Montana and ask for his permission. I mean, he doesn't know him, never met him, but he just, it's just the social cohesion that exists among them. Of course, they're also growing opium and pot and everything else in this country. In Seattle, they've been a big problem. And they eat dogs, which irritates some people. Puppies, actually, not dogs. Well, what's wrong with eating dog? I mean, they say, how can you eat rotten milk, which is cheese? And we say, how can you eat embryo eggs? Anybody had embryo eggs? Know what embryo eggs are? Yes. You like them? You don't. Well, they're eggs that are sort of become chickens. And they're served like a hard-boiled egg in a little cup. One of my first experiences in Vietnam, having gone through the State Department's meeting other people program, it's a brainwashing session they have. And now, when you go to Vietnam, you must remember many things. You must remember never to cross your legs when you're sitting on a platform at a public meeting. You know, 6 months later, I'm sitting there on the platform with 10 Vietnamese, and they've all got their legs crossed except me. And you say, I thought you weren't supposed to cross your legs. And they say, you're not. Or you never pat a child on the head. It's a sacred part of the body. I take kids through our market, everybody is patting them on the head. And you say to them, I thought you weren't supposed to pat kids on the head. You're not. One thing is, you do not insult their cuisine. Every culture, no matter where it is in the world, is very proud of their cuisine. And so you must always praise it. And so the first weekend we were in Vietnam, my wife, who had started to work at Vietnam Press and had met a Vietnamese woman who also was an editor there, and she invited us out to a very fancy restaurant out at Tu Duc along the river that specialized in embryo eggs. And I had never heard of an embryo egg up to that point, and so we're sitting there on the veranda, and she says, now for the finest part of the meal, embryo eggs. And so they bring, a real porcelain egg holder, just like you find in clubs in London, with the egg, regular chicken egg in it, still in, and you take a spoon and you knock off the top of it, like eating a hard-boiled egg, or soft-boiled egg, actually. And you look in, and here is this little head. And the yolk, you know, it becomes the body of the bird. I mean, that's what the yolk, as it develops, is. And then that sort of white thing that springs off of it is the head. And so at a certain point, and these were well-selected eggs, there's the little, and then it's filled with fluid, kind of a colorless fluid. And so you just scoop it out and eat it. And, well, it doesn't have much flavor. I mean, it tastes a little like chicken, and it tastes a little like egg, and it tastes a but it's mostly the idea of it. And our mistake, my wife and I would say, that is very good. Yes. Oh, you like it? Okay, we'll order two more. Deer's blood soup, have you ever had that? There's a place, or raw deer meat, that was another That wasn't so bad, though. I mean, if you like steak tartare, well, you could eat... The restaurant here now is serving raw lamb. Place on University, very big specialty. Very thin slices of lamb. I've never tried it. Well, they have some very good dishes. You can't really complain too much about another people's cuisine. It's what they like, and they're not cooking it for you. And it's just a case of either you like it or you don't like it. And almost everything in Vietnam, the cha za, for example, is a kind of egg roll or spring roll, I think are much better than the Chinese. It's a different material. What else do they have? Shrimp on sugar cane, it's very good. That something, I don't know exactly what it is, rice and pork wrapped in banana leaves. I forget what, it's pretty good. In most cases, you don't ask too much what it is. You take a bite of it. If it seems to be okay, you don't say, "What is this?" You just eat it. What you don't drink is milk and so on. I first went to Asia. That was a doctor I knew ran a leprosarium on Okinawa. I think he was a Nazi war criminal who was hiding out. He certainly looked like one and spoke like one. But anyway, he said, don't drink milk, don't drink ice cream. Eat anything else in Asia, it won't hurt you. And I did. I've eaten it all, except milk. All right, well, enough on Laos and cuisine. Isn't there anything on these questions that you feel uneasy about? Or?
Can you tell me the story you were going to tell me about the money from the last regime?
Oh, yes. Right, well, this has larger than life meaning. When I went back, I was... I'd been in Vietnam, I'd been out of Washington, or been in the Foreign Service abroad for 15 years straight out in Asia. And this is very unusual. I'd never had a tour of duty in Washington. And so I get a telegram in about December of 1974 saying, "Please come home," or "You are now ordered home." And I say, "Please." Said, "You are now ordered home. You have been out 15 years, and there is a law in the Foreign Service which says that in the first 15 years you must spend 2 at least in Washington, and you've never done this. So you are hereby ordered to come home. So I took that in to the ambassador, Graham Martin, and he said, "Oh, don't worry about it. I'll fix it up." And the next thing, I get an order to come home. A little unusual because, you know, I was just an Indian in the woodwork, and normally if an ambassador wants you to stay or wants you to do anything, Washington doesn't care. And they had no plans for me back there anyway. But then Martin called me in and said, "Well, I just got this personal letter from Kissinger saying he's very sorry he can't accept this, but it is a law. It's not a regulation or an administrative rule, it's in the Enabling Act of the Foreign Service. And as Kissinger says here, we've gotten into a little trouble around here recently by bending the law, so we are not going to do it anymore for a while. And so for that reason, and that, of course, meant that I got out in very good order. I had these 17 tons of books and all the stuff you find at the archives, which I got out in very good order. All the teak and rosewood furniture we'd had made in Hong Kong, everything. We moved it all out. I was one of the last few people that got their household goods out. the rest of them lost everything because they just got in an evacuation. And of course, a lot of Vietnamese believe that I saw the end coming, and I just quietly slipped out just at the last minute. I didn't see it coming, but I can't convince them of it. Anyway, the point is, we could not even get out at the end 17 tons of gold, 20 tons of gold. 20 tons of gold, which belonged to the GVN, which had been moved out to the airport, was under guard out there. There was a big hullabaloo because the press got onto this and said, President Thieu was trying to take all this gold out of the country and, you know, keep it for himself. And Thieu, when we contacted him, said, I'm just trying to get it out of the country. If you want to get it out of the country, send in your airplanes and take it to a military base in the Philippines or U.S. You know, just don't let the communists get it. That's all I'm saying. So I'd gone back to Washington, and I think partly because of this turning down Martin, Kissinger asked me to join his policy planning group, a kind of think tank on the seventh floor. I don't really think I'd have been there otherwise. So anyway, I was given the job of watching Vietnam on a kind of policy basis and doing whatever could be done administratively, which wasn't much at this time, but that was the job I was given about a week before the end, was to get this gold out. And so what I was instructed to do was to first try to get the Air Force to fly it out, and they couldn't or wouldn't, and then try to get Swiss Air, who agreed to fly it out. Send in a plane, pick it up, and take it to Travis in California. And there was a mix-up at the end in which they reneged on one flight on the grounds that their lawyer said, if the plane goes down, then you can be sued for loss of this gold. So then we had to send Geneva a waiver, you know, saying if the plane crashes, we will not hold you responsible. So. Anyway, it went right down to the wire, and the plane was in Bangkok, and within, you know, minutes of taking off, this was April 30th, and suddenly the whole thing was coming apart, and there the 20 tons of gold was sitting at the tarmac out at Tansanut, and it was still sitting there when the communists arrived. And so then the next thing that I read in Nhan Zan is about a week later, saying, among the glorious accomplishments of our glorious forces who gloriously captured Saigon was they captured a total of 15 tons of gold. 15 tons. And so the next thing we know, this gold starts showing up in the camps in Thailand and in Malaysia and Indonesia, and it's, you know, government gold. It's in bars mostly. It's got a government chop on it, so there's no question where it came from. But we heard that this was turning up, so then we sent an intelligence request, saying, "Would you really find out from us where this, who's got this gold? You know, who is it that's actually bringing it in?" And then the report, and this was to the Malaysian and Indonesian intelligence services, and the report comes back saying, you know, it's very hard to understand, but it appears that these people are in the intelligence business. And of course, for us, it wasn't hard to understand at all. They're the ones that got their hands on it. And so, naturally, there was a few of them who figured this is a ticket out of here. So it was filtering out for years, and it still continues to filter out. I think the bulk of it actually went into the government coffers.
So it was the North Vietnamese intelligence.
Not very many, apparently, but I suppose it would be a great temptation to. You've got a ton of gold there that you can take for yourself, that nobody knows how much is there. Yeah, well, I think it was done by several hundred people. I don't know, it was impossible to find it. A lot of it went, had gone through several hands. Gold has just been coming out of Vietnam for 15 years. There's far more gold there than anybody realized existed. I bought some gold there at the time. I could get it for $40 an ounce. It's now $400 an ounce. I bought about a pound of it. The trouble is, for the last 10 years, it's been right there about $400. I haven't made a dime on it. Should have sold it.
Was the gold showing up in, you say it was showing up like in
No, it was refugees. It was emigres, the refugees that were coming out. And I assume that some of these people that came out were North Vietnamese security people who were passing themselves off as South Vietnamese refugees. I mean, we sent word back that you better check out anybody that comes in with this. Check out who they really are. But by that time, the thing was, you know, gone. Okay, any questions, puzzlements?
I have another question, but everybody...
Go ahead.
Can you say more about what happened with Ted and Dan and Len?
All right, well, most of the winter-spring offensive, 1967-68, most of the combat was put on the shoulders of the PLAF. As you may know, that there were these two forces, the North Vietnamese, or PAVN, People's Army of Vietnam, and the indigenous forces of the National Liberation Front, People's Liberation Armed Force, PLAF. Early years of the war, almost all of the combat, very early years of the war, all of the combat was on the shoulders of the PLAF. By the 1972 Easter Offensive, about 90% of the day-to-day combat was on the shoulders of the PAVN, the North Vietnamese. So it had moved. PLAF participation had gone down steadily, and the PAVN had gone up. And the real turning point on this was in 1968, when in the Tet Offensive of 68, which is the middle part of that winter-spring offensive, virtually all of the PLAF units, or the major ones, were thrown into the city combat, in which, unlike previous guerrilla war, which was mostly in the countryside, leaving the urban areas alone, this reversed it. Fighting went on in the cities. 32 of the major population centers of the country, which is virtually all of them, were scenes of considerable fighting, some as in Hue for 30 days or a little more, in Saigon, Cholon for a couple of weeks. This was almost done entirely by the PLAF. The PAVN was they were PAVN units in Hue. That was the only place really where there were any to amount to anything. For the most part, the North Vietnamese PAVN just sat on their hands through the whole second phase of this and didn't engage in combat at all. One theory for this is that they were going to be used in stage three. The winter-spring offensive was in three-month periods. And the second period, January, February, and March of 68, was supposedly independent fighting methods, General Jopp called them, by PLAF, and that therefore PAVN would be used in the last 3 months. But is that the wind or ghosts? Or one explanation for why PAVN wasn't used was that they were being held in reserve for the final coup de grace that was going to come in the third phase. But things didn't develop in the first two stages the way that they should have in order to begin stage three the way it was planned, so the thing was broken off. There was heavy fighting during this period, but it didn't go the way they expected. The other explanation is, which most South Vietnamese, including most ex-Viet Cong, believe, is that the Northerners just deliberately threw all of the PLAF units into these cities, knowing that they would be decimated, as they were, and just gutted the whole PLAF. And they had done this, according to this thesis, because they were very much afraid that the war was about over, they were about to win it, and that they would have this very formidable force in the south, who would be the Viet Cong, who would be opposed to more northern involvement, and that therefore they would wind up, the North Vietnam, Hanoi, would wind up as they did after the Viet Minh War, where they win the war and they lose the peace. So they were determined not to repeat this mistake. Now there really isn't much evidence to support this, but I think every South Vietnamese that I know believes that this is true. And a lot of the Viet Cong, ex-Viet Cong I know, believe it to be true. And if you run into enough people who tell you that it's true, you begin to think that it's true yourself, even though none of them can offer you any kind of evidence of this. I see it more as the kind of the conspiratorial nature of Vietnam society, which is that there is a great deal of this sellout and double dealing and betrayal. In fact, it's the norm. And therefore, the Vietnamese are not surprised when it happens. I mean, it's what they expect to happen oftentimes. So that may mean then that it's true or that it isn't true.